On This Week in Enterprise Talk, we talk about what organizations should be doing to ensure they're safe from cyber attacks. Plus, we have a great guest where Brian Curtis and I talk with Alex Henthor-Nuwani from 1000 Eyes about cyber attack detection and network visibility. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 334, recorded March 22nd, 2019. The internet is an unregulated chain of trust. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Envoy. Envoy builds beautiful modern software to help businesses elevate the physical workplace experience. With Envoy visitors, you can greet guests with a welcoming, sleek iPad sign-in app while still protecting your people, property, and ideas. Start your free trial today at envoy.com/twit. And by 1000 Eyes. Companies that run in the cloud rely on 1000 Eyes. It's the place they go first to see, understand, and improve the digital experience of their cloud-based applications and services. Do the cloud right and improve services for your customers and employees today. Visit 1000eyes.com/twit. And by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT can be by giving their products a try for free. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moresky, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need a little help from my friends, especially my misfits, my co-hosts in crime, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, how's the weather down there in the swamp?
Well, here in the swamp, it's a beautiful day, and it looks like it's going to be leading into a beautiful weekend, so that's a grand thing. It's just the kind of weather that spring breakers like when they come to Florida, and it's the kind of weather we like to have for them. Meanwhile, I'm going to be avoiding all the spring breakers and staying right here with you and the rest of the Twyatt Riot.
Well, we definitely love having you here, but we have not one but two enterprise tech professionals with us today. Our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi, Director of Advanced Network Computing Lab in Honolulu. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
What do you keep busy down there in paradise down there? Keeping busy?
Always busy. Trying to set up some new surveillance cameras. And you know what? Our friends at Axis Communications, the camera guys, have some really cool new products. And who knows, I might actually be adding some access control systems from them. So look forward to comments and snide remarks.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we have a great show for you today. We're going to talk a little about how organizations should be, what they should be doing to ensure that they're safe or won't become victim to cyber attacks. Plus, we have a great guest to talk about network visibility and how your organization's connected experience is. But before we do, before we get to all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, just a short time after reading Mr. Mark Zuckerberg proclaiming that they're going to focus more on security and privacy, we have more news from Facebook, this time from an internal whistleblower on security and privacy. According to the sources, Facebook employees were storing users and username passwords for those users in plain text, making it searchable for thousands of employees. Now, we've heard of this type of issue before from likes of Uber, where their contractors were storing user data, including videos, on open source servers. But Facebook, on the other hand, has 200 million and 600 million users, Facebook users, having their account passwords stored in plain text and searchable by more than 20,000 Facebook employees. Now, the interesting thing about this is Facebook was aware. They're in the process of investigating, and they plan to alert the affected Facebook users, but that no password resets will be required. Now, that's the interesting part here. The company has set up a task force that wrote software to detect such issues in the system. Although credentials were logged, Facebook feels that at no time this information was at risk of a breach. Now, they do trust their employees over there quite a bit, but if I were you, I would go at least change your password.
Well, for some good news on the security front, Microsoft is bringing Defender to macOS. Microsoft is renaming its Windows Defender antivirus protection tool to Microsoft Defender and bringing its security capabilities to macOS devices starting this week in a limited preview mode now available to businesses. As part of the expansion, Windows Defender ATP will be renamed to Microsoft Defender ATP, and the Threat and Vulnerability Management, or TVM, capabilities available in Microsoft Defender will also be made available as part of this shift. The Microsoft Defender update with TVM brings a new capability designed to help security teams discover, prioritize, and address known vulnerabilities and misconfigurations. Now, to be considered for the Microsoft Defender Mac preview, you must have a Microsoft Defender ATP tenant and one or more macOS computers in your environment. Speaking of that, Microsoft says the reason for expanding Microsoft Defender's platform was requests from enterprise customers for malware protection that could be deployed and managed from a single integrated console.
Well, you know, this is, it had to happen. Apparently, some hackers managed to pull off a $20 million bank heist, and experts are attributing it to sloppy and insecure network architecture in Mexico. So in January 2018, a group of hackers, now thought to be working for the North Korean state-sponsored group Lazarus, attempted to steal $110 million from the Mexican commercial bank, Bank Comex. That effort failed. But just a few months later, a smaller yet still elaborate series of attacks allowed hackers to siphon off 300 to 400 million pesos, or roughly $15 to $20 million, from Mexican banks. Here's how they did it. So this was revealed at the RSA Security Conference in San Francisco the other week. Penetration tester and security advisor Josu Loza, who was also incident responder in the wake of the April attacks, presented findings on how hackers executed the heist both digitally and on the ground around Mexico. The hackers' affiliation remains publicly unknown. Loza emphasizes that while the attacks likely required extensive expertise and planning over months or even years, they were enabled by sloppy and insecure network architecture within the Mexican financial system and security oversights by SPEI, Mexico's domestic money transfer platform run by Central Bank Banco de Mexico, also known as Banxico. Similar fraud using the international money transfer system SWIFT have cropped up around the world, including notorious incidents in Ecuador, Bangladesh, and Chile. But SPEI is owned and operated by Banxico and only used within Mexico. In the aftermath of the April attacks, the bank tightened its policies and controls around fund transfers to establish minimum cybersecurity standards for Mexican banks that link their systems to SPEI. My big comment is, ouch. Having done some design work for funds transfer systems in the past, I tried to introduce biometrics in order to even start the process, but got a whole lot of pushback on people not wanting to put their eye to the reader. While biometrics is certainly not the whole answer, it would have been a good start if we had tried it 20 years ago when I tried it first. It occurs to me that the international banking community needs to get their collective act together.
Now, the FCC, they're always under fire, but they haven't really lost that many fights until now. Now, the FCC is now required to pay a New York journalist, Jason Prechtel, over $43,000 in regards to records he initially requested almost 2 years ago concerning its 2017 net neutrality proceeding. Now, what data was he requesting? Well, it was data revealing on how investigators had linked various entities, including a prominent Washington, D.C. publication, to potentially millions of fraudulent comments submitted during the 2017 net neutrality rollback. Now, earlier this week, the FCC admitted in a separate but related FOIA lawsuit brought by New York Times that its public comment system lacked the technical capacity to track who was responsible for the flood of counterfeit comments and received during the notice and comment process. Now, the same data was previously withheld from law enforcement investigators by the FCC's top lawyer, citing jurisdictional and privacy concerns. Prechtel eventually obtained it from FOIA from a separate agency. Now, judges are empowered under FOIA to assess against the United States reasonably attorney fees and other litigation costs reasonable incurred. Now, when according to the statute, the plaintiff has substantially prevailed, and that the fees enabled for the attorneys make it more of a make it easier for pro bono cases for journalists like Pretschel who are not supported financially by large corporations. Now, the lesson here is if you're willing to take the time to fight back, sometimes you don't need to be able to afford a lawyer to exercise your FOIA rights.
Well, after the good security news of my last blip, how about some less good news? Turns out less than 3% of recycled computers have been securely wiped. Want to hear some really bad news about what could be a really good impulse? Well, now think about all of those computing devices that wind up at businesses that refurbish computers or accept donated devices. Out of 85 devices tested by researchers at Rapid7, only 2 were wiped properly. And only 3 had been encrypted to start with. A researcher tested desktops, laptops, removable media, hard drives, and cell phones from 31 businesses around his home in Wisconsin. At the end of a 6-month project, he found that many of the refurbishing and donation businesses don't actually wipe data from those devices as they promise. Now, the data he found on the exposed devices included 41 social security numbers, 19 credit card numbers, 2 passport numbers, 147,000 email messages, and 214,000 images and photos. So what does all this mean? It means that companies should be careful about everything from old ATM machines, printers, fax machines, computers, and smartphones to components that they want to reuse or recycle. And remember, if you don't have time to do a proper, secure disk wipe, you probably still have time to use a hammer.
You know, this is starting to feel like a theme, but here we go again. Comcast sets mobile pins to 0000, helping attackers steal phone numbers. And in this case, it's Xfinity Mobile tried to deploy a fix after weak pin system fueled number porting attacks. Well, let's go dig into that. So it was a bad security decision by Comcast, and the company's mobile phone servers made it easier for attackers to port cell phone numbers to different carriers. Comcast in 2017 launched Xfinity Mobile, a cellular service that uses Verizon wireless network and Comcast Wi-Fi hotspots. Comcast has signed up 1.2 million mobile subscribers, but took a shortcut in the system that lets users switch from Comcast to other carriers. The bottom line is that users really need to change their security PIN, and if you're having trouble finding where to change it, call your carrier. The normal process to move your existing number to a new carrier is you need to request what is called a porting authorization code, or PAC, from your old provider and let your new provider know the code. They will then schedule the switch. What Comcast has done is lazy and set all the codes to 0000 instead of a random PIN for protection. Bah humbug.
Now, it seems like sci-fi to talk about storing data in DNA. Johnny Mnemonic seems to come to mind here, but researchers from Microsoft and the University of Washington think it's time to start moving forward with it. Now, they have demonstrated the first fully automated system to store and retrieve data in manufactured DNA. Now, in a simple proof of concept test, the team successfully encoded the word hello in snippets of fabricated DNA and converted it back to digital data using fully automated end-to-end system. Now, the DNA can store digital information in a space that is orders of magnitude smaller than data centers used today. With the amount of data people are generating each day, new solutions like these may actually help data centers and provide a way forward. Now, information is stored in synthetic DNA molecules created in the lab, not DNA from humans or other living things. So don't worry about that. And it can be encrypted before it's sent to the system. Now, while sophisticated machines such as synthesizers and sequencers are already performed key parts of the process, many of the intermediate steps until now have required manual labor in the research lab. Now, this new automated process is a key step forward in moving the technology out of the research lab and into the commercial data centers. Who knows, your DigiPet might be more molecular here in the future. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we get into the bites, but first we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Envoy. Now, when guests visit your business, your kiosk or your booth or even your event, they always have first impressions. They always want to be able to say, hey, I want to be able to interact and find the right person that I need to find very easily and make it easy for them to arrive and check in. Well, Envoy Visitors changes the game. It's time to welcome guests to the modern lobby and be ready for everything that comes through your front door. Now, Envoy Visitors is an iPad kiosk that makes workplaces more efficient. Now, how does this actually work? Well, when visitors arrive, they sign in on an iPad kiosk, they enter their details and sign any legal documents like NDAs right there on the iPad. Now, Envoy then notifies their host and that they've actually arrived and all checked in. And Envoy will automatically alert any employee when a guest has arrived so that you don't actually need to intervene or you need anybody else to intervene in the process. Now, it also keeps everyone informed. You need to know who is coming in, when they're coming in. It makes for less awkward meetings when you don't realize they're here and ready for you. Now, here are the benefits of using kind of Envoy Visitors. Boost your office efficiency with smart security that doesn't intimidate anybody. There's no more paper logbook that doesn't provide real value. So you can sign in unlimited visitors. You can print badges, customize badges. Really great, easy features here. It even notifies administrators about unattended guests. You can integrate with your existing security system like Wi-Fi access, ID checks, and emergency notifications, which will actually add to your security perimeter and strength. So that's really great. Plus, you'll have data on all your visitors in your office so you know who's coming in, when they're on site, and who they're meeting and why. Envoy Visitors works with tools you already have, like, for instance, Slack and G Suite, Box, and Salesforce Chatter. Plenty more there, too, as well. They're also designed to help companies of all types, including those in highly regulated industries, meet those security needs and compliance requirements. So they make it really easy to do that. You can join companies like Nike, Pinterest, and Spotify that work with Envoy to help welcome over 30 million guests. Protect your people, property, and ideas the welcoming way with Envoy. See why 10,000 workplaces worldwide choose Envoy to make a great, great first impression. Go to envoy.com/twit and start your free trial today. That's envoy.com/twit. And we thank Envoy for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into the bites. When it comes to cybersecurity, that whole mindset of assume breach helps you kind of kickstart your campaign to fight the darkness. Now, cyber attacks are super expensive. We all know that, and they're on the rise. They're moving up. They're coming more and more often. Now, the question is, where are businesses falling short and when it comes to protecting themselves? Well, I'm going to start a short discussion here with my co-host because there's a short list here. There's a 5 items. But I don't know necessarily think these are the only 5 items. So let's go through a couple of them. The first one being patching cadence. Now, you aren't doing you're not patching fast enough in this case in an organization. So because of the size of the network, sometimes people propagate updates or patches slowly. And so that tends to mean that they patch more slowly. Sometimes IT organizations are worried that, hey, if I go and update a system, it's going to break some of my other critical applications that I need. So they kind of weigh the difference between whether I should update or not update. But in this case, weighing between an issue versus a zero-day exploit, you kind of might want to choose the system side. But again, that a lot of organizations kind of go back and forth with that. Okay, number 2, relying on antivirus is just too strong. Well, that's true. A lot of organizations kind of rely on these perimeter systems like firewalls and antivirus systems to protect them from, especially email. And I think that's kind of a losing battle here. Once hackers infiltrate that perimeter, they have free rein of your assets. Even if you want to prevent email-based attacks, sometimes you have to stay away from things like attachments where you have to use third-party storage companies and so on for attachments. So that's another one big issue. Number 3, your users are unaware. They're not actually aware that they're of cybersecurity and what needs to be done. You have to go and train your users. You have to make them more aware, understand the signals, such as phishing attacks. If they're not unaware and they're uninformed, sometimes they're not looking for these things. You have to communicate the risks to your users and what to look for to help your business. Number 4, accept the inevitable. Assume breach. Plan for the worst. Understand that you have possibly been already hacked and go and take action. Monitor, report, resolve. So those are just 5. Now, guys, I want to throw it over to you because obviously these are not the only 5, but in this particular article saying, hey, this could be some things that could definitely help organizations. Is there something missing, Chiba? I want to start with you. Is there something missing from this list? Is it a good list?
It's a good start. I've got a problem with number one, but let's go and add one first. And my okay. thing is, I hate perimeter everything. You should no longer be assuming that anything behind the corporate firewall is safe. It's not. We really ought to be running more zones. Even if it's something as simple as just hacking up the collision domain so you get better performance, as long as you have multiple zones so that you have more areas to examine data in your IDS IPS system, I think that's a good thing, and it does not cost a lot of money. VLANs are easy, folks. Now, I do have a little bit of problem with number one, patching cadence. You know, while I say, yeah, we should patch quickly, we should update quickly and so forth, the problem is the number one reason why I run a draft system is because patches break apps. And so I'm a big believer in using the Windows Update Server so that I can roll them out at my pace and test it against my draft system to find out whether something's broken or not. I know it sounds like an awful lot of work, but if you have custom apps or you're running a DevOps system and your bread and butter is dependent upon these apps, I think you really ought to consider, you know, taking a hard look at running something like Windows Update Server so that you can more closely control when you roll those apps out. But that's my opinion.
It's a good opinion. I want to throw over to Kurt, too, because I think, obviously, like you said, it's not the only list. Kurt, what do you think? Is it a good list? Should we add to it? Should we subtract from it, maybe?
I don't know about subtracting from it. I think that it's a good place to start. And I think that there are things like the patching and updating cadence that I would amend. I would start with just patch. So many of the massive malware outbreaks that we have seen come from companies that don't patch. You know, this says that you're not patching fast enough. You know, I think patching within the same calendar year that the patch or update is issued is probably a good thing. That's a good thing to have on your list. We know that there are systems that haven't been fully patched and updated for a decade or more, and that is in today's world absolutely begging for trouble. You know, there are methodologies like DevOps and now the DevSecOps that look to solve some of these problems because they roll everything together. They break down the barriers between development, security, and operations and try to make sure that we are patching more regularly, that we are building security into software more regularly, and that we are, to use the terminology of DevOps, treating everything as software. In other words, no matter what it is, we treat it as something that can be patched, updated, and revved quickly as needed. I think those are really good ideas. But the one that I keep coming back to, the one that's on your list, is those pesky users. You know, I haven't worked for a company that has not had some sort of anti-phishing training as part of its onboarding for a decade or more. And most companies, in fact, do have some anti-phishing, anti-bad behavior built into their corporate training. And yet it just doesn't get through. And I'm not sure whether that's because the users aren't convinced of the importance or something that I have begun to see as a bigger issue. A huge number of the employees out there who are working with corporate systems are doing things by rote. That's why a company like Microsoft that is on so many enterprise desktops has to think long and hard before they make even the slightest change to a menu or dropdown. Because if they do that, they know that their customers are going to have to retrain employees, and that gets really expensive. So if we can figure out that layer 8 user interface issue and incorporate more of a mindset that makes changes along the way, I think that we will take many of the problems that we deal with and at least reduce their severity.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point. I think, I always say you're only as good as your weakest link, and that tends to be your users. I've been in organizations and I've seen in organizations where they've sent out campaigns like, they'll send out a phishing attack internally to show, hey, like, you know, report this. Normally they try to train their users, hey, report this if you see something fishy, and they actually see how many people actually report it. They make it super easy to report. I've seen just like links, add-ins to your email clients, send a chat message to this alias, that kind of thing. And so they make it really easy. It's interesting to see how many people actually click on the links or actually interact with these phishing attacks. I've actually even seen theatrics where they send videos around, required videos you have to take. Where they have like theatrical, kind of Hollywood theatrics that they do within there to keep it entertaining, keep people involved. Sometimes it just doesn't make a dent. Brian, I want to throw it to you. I mean, Curtis brings up a good point here. I mean, users and awareness is a hard thing. Is there anything else that we can do to make this better?
I'm actually stunned. You know, there's a lot of problems out there. Anyway, the whole concept of isolated browsers and things like that. Aircom actually has one that was pretty interesting. Our friends at Citrix are starting to play in the same game. I'm actually thinking, you know, this is just me playing wishful thinking, is that if a user is not willing to play ball, then you stick them in a cage so that if they do click on something that's a phishing attack, that it's at least restricted to that one session. There's an awful lot of folks that I've had to work with over the years, and you know, they shouldn't have computers. You know, that it's kind of coming down to that. You know, it's like, you know, put them in a caged session so that if they do something stupid, it's at least isolated. And you know, and Lou, you should have laughed, because this is one of those things where we don't want to believe it's happening. But one of my favorite sayings is, sadly, there's a lot of stupid people out there and they're still going to click on those phishing links.
True. It's true. You know, I have some family members that work at banks, and there's a lot of impedance in their workflows because their machines are locked down. They can't open attachments. They can't send attachments. They can't click on links unless it goes through a special third party or vendor system that verifies them first. I mean, it creates a lot of impedance to their workflow. I've seen people just like go onto their cell phones and open a link instead because they just don't want to wait for their desktop or their laptop. So, you know, there's a kind of a spectrum, and sometimes it's just hard. Like you said, because if just users are your weakest link sometimes. Well, folks, that does it for that one. Let's go ahead and jump into the next one, because I think this was fairly interesting as well. And Kurt, I'll throw it to you.
Well, thanks, Lou. You know, one of the words that I've been hearing at the recent RSA conference and really at pretty much every security conference I've gone to in the past few years is visibility. It's an area that people struggle with all over security. And one of the main developments that we're seeing in computing technology, well, it's making it a little bit worse. Back in April of 2014, Google announced that one of its researchers found a critical vulnerability in OpenSSL. That's software that's used to encrypt connections to web servers and other internet hosts. To figure out what the risk was from this vulnerability, security professionals and academic researchers began scanning the 4.3 billion addresses on the internet looking for unpatched servers vulnerable to the now infamous Heartbleed flaw. Researchers weren't the only ones searching the internet. Within a few days, attacks came from more than 700 different sources, according to a 2014 paper published by a team of researchers from various universities. Now, The ability to gain this kind of intelligence in the future may disappear. Why? All comes down to IPv6. Right now, about a quarter of internet users connect to Google over IPv6. That's up from just 5% 4 years ago. As service providers adopt the next generation internet protocol, IPv6 is going to become more common, and researchers worry that their ability to exhaustively search the network is going to fail. Now, why would this be true? Well, where IPv4 had that 4.3 billion addresses that I mentioned a moment ago, IPv6 internet has 2 to the 128th power addresses, which is somewhere in excess of a million billion more IPv6 addresses than astronomers estimate that there are stars in the known universe. So if it took a single second to scan the entire IPv4 address space, it would take 25 billion billion centuries to scan all of the available IPv6 address. Now, in a March 2018 blog post, a couple of researchers over at Cisco Talos highlighted the issues. They said that enumerating all the active hosts by scanning the address space is practically and theoretically infeasible. So this means that we're looking at a theoretical and legitimate ever larger number of hosts in future internet surveys that are in a hole, that simply aren't found. And this is especially critical as we bring more and more unsecure Internet of Things devices online. So what are they going to do? Well, researchers aren't giving up. At Rapid7, which is a vulnerability management firm, their research director says that it comes down to tricks. Your server, for example, can't be found unless you're advertising its address. Now, Rapid7 does regular scans of the entire IPv4 space for about 70 different protocols. I know this because I have used those scans. It's called Project Sonar, as the basis for articles that I've written. They have not yet developed a way to provide anything similar to that for IPv6. Now, in that blog post that I mentioned earlier from Cisco Talos, they described one way that servers could be located in IPv6 space. Universal plug and play, usually referred to as UPnP, which allows automatic network discovery on local networks, can be exposed. It shouldn't be, but it often is exposed to the internet. And it can be fooled into having those devices give up their IPv6 addresses. So the researchers sent out UPnP notify packets to every IPv4 address, and they found about 12,000 devices that advertised their IPv6 address. So this, while very small, showed a way that they might work. Another option comes from the search system known as Shodan. Again, this is one that I have used. If you don't have a subscription, I suggest you do if you're at all interested in security research, because they came up with the idea of having systems connect to them. There's nothing you can do at that point. They can scan you if you are connected. There are all kinds of things that can be done. Other people have suggested using NTP, that's the Internet Time Protocol, because servers and devices will typically go out and request time. This is a problem. We keep talking about visibility, and we keep running into situations that are going to make the visibility more difficult. I had a conversation at the RSA conference with Cricket Liu, who we have had on the show here. He's chief DNS architect over at Infoblox. And he said that one of the things that surprised him was the rapid rise in the number of total traffic that they're seeing from IPv6 devices. Part of that is because while your desktop computer going through your ISP may or may not be using IPv6, your mobile device, your smartphone, your tablet, almost certainly is using IPv6 because the carriers know that they need those addresses. So I'm going to turn to my co-host, first to Brian out there in Hawaii. Brian, I know you've spent an awful long time looking at network protocols, assembling networks. How big an issue do you see this question of visibility, and do you see an easy way for a technology fix?
Yeah. No, there's no easy way. It's all going to require a lot of cooperation. Now, keep in mind how IPv6 works. It's right now relatively rare for people to be running DHCP v6. So that, you know, that kind of narrows things down a little bit. Most people use neighbor discovery. Now, neighbor discovery is done by the upstream router. It goes and says, oh, you're a neighbor. You're not in a deny list. Okay, I'll give you an IP. You can use this IPv6 address. Well, so for instance, let's use my lab as an existence. out of a slash 60, which is a heck of a lot of address space, I'm actually only using one slash 64 actively and one slash 64 for routing. So out of a very, very large address space, I'm using very few. So if we were somehow magically able to figure out how to harvest my neighbor discovery lists, instead of having to find, you know, several million addresses, it would really only have to find, in my instance, 10. Lot different number. So perhaps this is something that has to be done in the IETF and IEEE. There needs to be perhaps a way of harvesting the neighbor discovery. IPv6 is inevitable. You know, there is no more IPv4 address unless some various folks that have very large chunks, like class A addresses, actually clean up their shop and give some back. Interop did, but a lot of other people that have class A addresses are just sitting fat, dumb, and happy and sitting on a very, very large amount of IPv4 address space that's unused. Hint, hint, hint. But for IPv6, yeah, neighbor discovery, I think, is the only technology I can think of right off the top of my hat that might come close to solving this. How the heck do we find these V6 devices?
Yeah, I think your statement that IPv6 is inevitable is absolutely true. This isn't a question of, well, this gives us the reason that we've got to hang out with IPv4. We just can't. As Brian said, there are some address spaces that could be turned back over. But even if everyone who had unused addresses turned them back to the system, I think that would probably buy us a couple of months of new devices coming on. And when it comes to IoT and mobile devices, if we don't want to have, you know, every individual ISP just natting the dickens out of all their customers, we've got to use IPv6. So it's coming. Lou, I'm curious, when you hear something about this with the visibility issue, do you, as a developer, come up with any things that you have done or that your teams have done that you think might be applicable? Or is this one of those problems that might just be intractable unless we move the goalpost and change the definition of success?
So, Kurt, that's actually a great question. I think we use a lot of managed services, so we tend to worry less about this because we have these virtual networks that get created for us and they're kind of handled for us. And I think so we do a lot less from a developer perspective. From a DevOps perspective, a deployment perspective, we use a lot of deployment services that need to be able to manage and understand what's on our network, where it is, what it's next to, its performance, that kind of thing. And so being able to catalog all that information is important, and also to see and get visibility into what's affecting that performance, what's affecting the network in that case. And so there's a lot of scale out. I think Brian's talking about, hey, there's approaches of maybe doing this, and some of them tend to be more brute force based. But how can we do this more in a managed way? How can we do this in more of a scale out way? And so I've seen a lot of people actually spinning up services, nodes around the world that kind of do this in parallel to be able to catalog this information so that they have more visibility. So there's a lot of approaches at doing this. Again, sometimes we developers tend to spend less time thinking about that. And I think it's in the future we need to spend more time. So, but a really good question. Well, thanks, Kurt. This is a really interesting article. We want to get to our guests because we have really interesting guests to bring some information that actually applies to this stuff as well. But before we do, we want to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is ThousandEyes. Now, everyone watches those action sci-fi films where you show the war rooms and the walls of all these screens on the wall with all the data of their network. Well, wouldn't it be cool if that was a reality? Well, imagine if you had 1,000 eyes. You already know that the internet is the backbone of organizations and enterprises. It's a complex network of nodes and data, and when your business depends on it, you need to have really deep insights into the health and performance of it. Well, 1,000 eyes is going to make it easier for you and your organization. Now, nowadays, there's tons of cloud apps, PaaS service, SaaS services like Office 365, Webex, Salesforce, and more. And you have to have a view or the lay of the land of that network and internet of all times. Now, you need to know how it could or is right now actually affecting your customers and their experiences. Well, it's in the company name. They give you more than 1,000 eyes to surface the data you need to provide best-in-class service and view of your network. Now, you might say, well, it's got to be hard to set up, deploy, and get started. Well, 1,000eyes has found a way to make this easy to deploy and start collecting data in no time. They have a concept of network agents. You deploy these agents throughout the network, and you're instantly able to visualize, monitor, and diagnose your networks. Whether you deploy on virtual appliances, Hyper-V appliances, or others, they really make it easy to start getting valuable information about the networks that affect your business. Now, these agents are sensors that are deployed globally and give a pulse of data about what's going on with the network. Imagine if you had users and customers obtaining information from a service over in Japan. Well, your cloud agent in Japan can give you the data you need to diagnose any network issues that might be causing issues for your customers and performance issues for them. Now, global sets of customers are no problem for 1,000eyes. They give you the vantage point of the network you need to diagnose and solve. Now, they also have a concept of enterprise agents as well. Whether they're at a branch office or a data center, they give you that hybrid end-to-end view of the entire network. Now, I've used the power of 1,000eyes. It makes you really feel like you're in the driver's seat of your network, and you really understand what's going on with your services and what's affecting your services and your apps. And they really make it easy to follow too. 1,000eyes has put themselves in the point of view of your customers as well and your end users with their endpoint agents. All that data is collected and aggregated where it's processed and correlated for patterns. It truly is network intelligence. Now, it helps you collectively make sense of your entire network. Now, 1,000eyes also puts itself into the brain and the eyes of the network engineer or IT professional. Now, you probably envision your network to be kind of connected in some way, interconnected nodes. Well, you can't troubleshoot a network by just looking at charts and bar graphs and line graphs. You need a visualization of your network spatially. Well, that's where 1,000eyes provides a beautiful real-world set of visualizations that kind of can encapsulate that complexity of your network. They give you the data you need to run it proactively and reactively. Not only do they do that, but they also provide a unique path visualization technology, which extends any bench boundaries, allowing you to kind of see and understand and improve your experience for your apps, services, and websites. No more Wireshark figuring out your issues on your network. It's more than just an MPLS backbone. You need more than packet captures and netflows. 1,000eyes help you solve real-world issues with a unique, actionable data with really super cool visualizations. You can see there on the screen, really kind of neat way of visualizing your network and what's affecting it, kind of a complete view. Whether it's IP forwarding issues, BGP, VoIP, wireless LAN, internet outages or MPLS issues, Thousand Eyes has you covered. They even monitor and mitigate, help you mitigate with strategies for your network attacks like DDoS and more. Regain control of your network, ensure the best possible experience for your customers and employees. Get an immediate unmatched view of all your network's dependencies that impact your users' digital experience. Visit thousandeyes.com/twit to see what you've been missing. You'll get the exclusive ebook on the 5 cloud migration challenges you shouldn't ignore. If the cloud is important to you, either today or in the future, visit thousandeyes.com/twit. That's thousandeyes.com/twit. Thousand Eyes, thrive in a connected world. And we thank Thousand Eyes for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where we get to bring a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today's no exception. We have Alex Hathorn Uwani, VP of Product Marketing of Thousand Eyes. Hey, there's something familiar there. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Right, okay. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Now, Alex, our audience loves origin stories. They want. Could you kind of take us on a short journey through tech and how you ended up at Thousand Eyes?
Sure. Yeah. So when I started out in tech, it was sort of at the, let's just say, the beginnings of the commercial internet. So I got involved in one of the first companies I got involved in was a little company called Livingston Enterprises. And they made the dial-up concentrators that thousands of ISPs used around the world to connect people. They also happened to invent a AAA protocol called Radius, and I got to work on that and commercialize that technology to a ton of telcos and carriers, looking at the early starts of BGP and other routing protocols. And it's been really fascinating to see how, obviously, the internet has kind of exploded since then. So just kind of had a journey of looking at various types of technologies in the network management and orchestration and security space. And that's kind of led me about a year and a half ago to Thousand Eyes, because there's such a concentration of interesting data and perspectives here that was really interesting to me.
Fantastic. Now, Alex, we know a lot about Thousand Eyes, especially since they're a sponsor of Twit, but what we do want to kind of get into the context of organizations, like how they're handling outages, cyber threats, and that kind of, then we can kind of segue into gaining constant visibility for your connected systems. But before, we heard a little bit about Facebook having some trouble last week. They had a worldwide outage. What could have happened here? How could they have not known this was going to come and happen for them?
Well, first of all, that's interesting to think about is, you know, you've got Facebook, they're the largest app or service ever built, right? And you can consider all their properties now, it's truly unbelievable. And they've built incredibly resilient systems at unheard of scale, right? You know, they've built their architecture to help to withstand a sort of like Independence Day vaporization of a data center, right? That's how redundant, resilient they've built. But Obviously, there's a couple of major factors that can make that kind of thing complex. One is that they rely on a ton of automation, right? So they've got massive automation systems that deal with configurations and all that sort of thing. They're not. They're in a situation where you've got thousands of people typing on CLIs to run stuff. They automate extensively. And so that means that if something goes wrong in one of those automation routines or systems, the way I see it is that you could have a huge cascading effect. The other aspect is obviously they have a huge internet dependence because they're delivering a service over the internet. And so that's the whole domain that oftentimes people focus on. Some of the early speculation when this service outage started was, is this a hack? Is this a DDoS attack? And, you know, we got a lot of questions about that early on.
Right. I think that's an interesting case. I mean, you're saying, hey, a lot of things are automated. A lot of things are not naturally controlled by the developers. They're kind of controlled by their workflows and their process. I mean, the interesting thing I find here, though, is the fact that it was out for so long. These types of systems, what can organizations do, especially organizations like Facebook, improve, especially decrease that amount of outage time if they do have it and the cause of it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you think about a service that's built at that level of scale. I mean, the fact that it took down multiple services tells you is that this was something that probably was affecting some core piece of their service infrastructure. And, you know, obviously, you know, like these kind of companies like Facebook are famous for doing Chaos Monkey. They do a lot of active testing of their systems to make sure that they're resilient. I think that this is, well, first of all, this is the, you know, the largest outage. And obviously it was a very long outage, but they don't have them very often at this scale, right? They are kind of, organizations like Facebook are sort of at the cutting edge of doing everything possible to make sure that their production systems are sound. You know, so it's hard to, I'm sure they're doing a massive postmortem right now to think through, okay, what was missed here, you know? Right. But their level of sophistication is off the charts compared to the average, for example, enterprise, just due the amount of investment they can make. I mean, like if you look at their architecture, networking architecture, it's completely non-blocking, for example, you know? I mean, they have unlimited money to make sure that everything works well.
Right, right. Well, everyone needs their Instagram fix, right, Brian?
Yeah.
What do you think? Have anything for Alex here?
Well, you know, I think I want to back up just a little bit and ask a question that leads to the next section of this interview, and that's, why are you guys called Thousand Eyes? And was this your architecture what led you to being able to have a visibility into this Facebook outage?
Yeah, you know, the premise of Thousand Eyes really was, okay, the internet is going to be really key to how applications and services are delivered. So you need to have vantage points out on the internet to be able to look at, you know, how those services are getting to your users, how they're getting to those services. So whether those be getting to a data center or a CDN edge, that sort of thing. So in this case, when we noticed that there was an outage, what happened is we started looking at where are we seeing the outage from. So we started noticing that there was a bunch of different of our pre-deployed cloud agents that were seeing issues. And one of the things that we did, because when you're dealing with any kind of cloud-based service, whether it's consumer one like Facebook, although to be fair, there are a lot of Facebook services that are used by businesses globally, right? But when you're looking at that kind of service, the most difficult part of it is, well, what layer and where do you, you know, where is it happening? Is it, you know, if you're, let's say, for example, if you're an enterprise consuming a service, or, you know, is it us? Is it that service provider? You know, is it Facebook? Is it something in the middle? So we look at things at multiple layers. So we started looking at this because we were actively monitoring Facebook. And so we could see it at HTTP layer. We could see down below that at the network metrics end to end. We could see the full paths to at least to their CDN edge. We could see underneath that into BGP routing. So what we started looking at is, okay, is there something happening at HTTP that indicates that what layer this is? So for example, if DNS isn't resolving, we could see that. If it's a connect issue, like you're just not getting three-way TCP handshakes, or is there an SSL layer issue, and is that because of timeouts? Or is there, you know, a receive issue or something like that? And what we saw actually immediately was that these were HTTP, you know, 500 error codes, right? So it's just an internal server error. Now we looked underneath that, we didn't see any metric issues indicated for network latency or packet loss. We looked at the paths, and the paths looked whole. So for example, if it was a DDoS attack, we would have seen a lot of packet loss in the links going to Facebook. And that's, we've seen those kinds of scenarios before with other DDoS attacks. You just see tons and tons of packet loss. It indicates that the pipes are getting filled. And so that's kind of part of the way you can symptomatically see, like, yeah, this is probably a volumetric DDoS attack. We also looked at BGP. There was sort of a little bit of a speculative, almost spurious sort of story going around that this was a BGP routing issue. We were immediately able to see there's no BGP problem happening there. But the one thing we could see was there's this HTTP internal server error. So our first speculation was that, hey, don't blame the network. It's not a DDoS attack. This looks like it's internal to Facebook. And in fact, that's what it was.
Fantastic. Kurt, I want to throw it over to you because we have some questions about corporate view.
Yeah, I do. And, you know, one of the things that interests me on an architecture like this isn't so much doing what you expect to be done with it. I mean, obviously, you got all kinds of information that you can find. You were mentioning things like knowing which layer issues were occurring on and all kinds of things, some of which I've used as part of articles that I've written. My question to you is, do you have clients or do you there at Thousand Eyes ever use this reconnaissance for tasks that are a bit unusual? I mean, what sort of things are you able to find that people might not expect if all they've done is go and take a quick pass through your splash page on your website?
That's an interesting question. What things do we do that you don't expect to find? Well, I think one of the things that we have been working on this last year is benchmarking. It, you know, out in the cloud, you have all these services. You have public cloud services. You have DNS services. And there, what we found is just not a lot of data on how the internet aspect of these or how these things perform. And they're so massive and everybody depends on them. And so one of the things that we have done is said, well, we have all this visibility to create interesting metric data. So rather than go out and just take surveys and say, you know, how well do you like this service? Let's actually measure a bunch of these services and then let's go explore the why things work or perform or don't perform the way we might expect and really dig into those things. And we've ended up surfacing some interesting insights about, for example, you know, how the major cloud providers work and perform across the internet connecting to their data centers in places like Asia. Like, you know, Asia has relatively sparse fiber routes compared to North America or Western Europe. So there can be real variables in how, you know, your connection to a cloud provider region might work or perform. Or if you're constructing application architecture and we want to have a primary and a backup regional data center, which ones should you choose based on how they perform in terms of intercommunicating? So we've been able to start using this data, explore these questions. And we found that this really opened up a lot of good conversation with, you know, networking folks, enterprise architects, cloud architects, and all those sorts of folks, because that data just simply wasn't available before.
Right. Well, folks, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more with Alex about connectivity and visibility and connectivity outages and more. But before we do, we want to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Atlassian. Now, whether you are an engineer or IT team or one who just wants to manage a large team and their work items, you probably have used an Atlassian product or two. Now, I remember way back in 2002 when Atlassian launched their perfectly timed product that met the needs of that kind of emerging agile market. Originally, it was conceived as just a bug tracking tool, but the Jira ticket quickly became the digital record of choice for tracking units of work in really that highly collaborative and agile environment. Fast forward 16 years, DevOps is on everyone's docket, and Atlassian is still leading the pack in areas that helps teams rise to the occasions. For me, I've been using Bitbucket for years to manage some of my projects, source code, and documentation. Plus, tickets for those projects come through Jira, and I'm alerted in my Microsoft Teams channel of the issue. So it's kind of a really cool and integrated system. Atlassian really is a collaborative software company that empowers IT teams around the world. Now, like all organizations, you want to ship products faster, more efficiently, and with higher quality. Plus, you want to ensure your customers' feedback adds to the business value prop there. Now, sometimes businesses fall short because all their disjointed workflows, and this is where Atlassian's wheelhouse is. They give you and your organization and your IT team the power to manage complex collaborations. Atlassian provides the technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support the kind of change that propels your business forward. And plus, their tools and their services are not just for developers. They're for all different types of IT teams and all different types of teams. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all sizes, from DevOps to Agile, IT Ops to ITSM, and whatever's next. Now, Atlassian provides everything you need with Jira software, Confluence, Bitbucket. Atlassian forms the backbone of that effective cross-team project planning, organization, and communication. With Jira Ops, OpsGenie, and Status Page, they help many teams to better detect incidents, alert response teams, coordinate response efforts to resolve issues faster, and keep customers and those stakeholders updated. Your teams can choose tools that are right for your current framework while trusting as you grow, they can grow with you. Like all Atlassian products, the tools for your IT team are easy and free to try. Just head to Atlassian.com/IT to find out which Atlassian offering is right for your team. Try Atlassian today and see what IT can be. That's Atlassian.com/IT. And we thank Atlassian for their support of This Week and Enterprise Tech. And we're talking with Alex Henthorne-Iwani of Thousand Eyes. Full disclosure, they're actually a sponsor of Twyatt and DeSwitt Network, about connected networks and outages and how to get visibility into those networks. Curtis, you had some questions for Alex.
Well, I did. And Alex, I don't know if you heard the bits that we did before we brought you in, but one of them was on one of the issues with the growing use of IPv6 is the fact that we simply are literally unable to get the same breadth of visibility into IPv6 that we can get into IPv4. So from a Thousand Eyes perspective, what does the shift to IPv6 do to or for your technology? Do you have a way to keep the same level of visibility into a much larger address space?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we invested in pretty early on here was supporting supporting IPv6 monitoring of services, and particularly, like, for example, DNS as a core service, right? So one of the things, for example, we ran a global performance benchmark test of DNS resolvers, public resolvers, of managed providers, and of the core sort of infrastructure, DNS infrastructure. And we did that with V4 and V6. So as an example, we really do try to track and make that kind of visibility available for both V4 and V6. Some customers really care about that, depending on how much mobile usage they have, and some, of course, less. But that's been really important to us for quite some time.
So, Alex, what about, I want to get a little bit into, like, around cyber attacks and the kind of differences. Could you alluded to them before? You talked a little bit about volumetric, BGP. How are they? Are they all volumetric type attacks the same? Are they? Can they be alerted? Can they be detected the same way? What can organizations do to kind of figure this out?
So when you think about the internet as a domain of cybersecurity issues, not so much that, you know, it's a domain that hackers can get across to get to you, but what is it that you're depending on, right? So you're depending on the availability bandwidth, and that's what DDoS, you know, attacks, a volumetric DDoS attack will try to hit. You're relying on BGP routing so that folks can actually get to you, right? They need to have paths to get to your website, etc. Right. You need DNS to work now, so that when they type in a URL, they're actually getting to your server and not somewhere else. And so, for example, you know, DDoS is the one that's the most visible, but in some ways, DNS is the most insidious area that not enough folks are looking at. And this has been coming up, and there's been a lot of sort of government agencies sort of alerting on the vulnerabilities about DNS. And, you know, we've seen DNS hijack issues where, you know, a few years ago, a bunch of financial websites, you know, were hit by these sorts of things. So there was a major DNS service that was partially rerouted and then DNS hijacked as well, you know, for a cryptocurrency site. So there's, you know, the internet is kind of like a unregulated chain of trust. So because of that, it's exploitable. You know, it's possible for folks to monkey with your DNS records potentially. It's possible for folks, for, you know, malign actors to announce your routes and steer traffic away from your website to their network. And those kinds of things are oftentimes not paid attention to enough. Whereas the DDoS, the volumetric DDoS attack, lands with a big, you know, it's a big crash, right? You know, so people think about that, they write about that. And there are a variety of ways to detect DDoS attacks. One of the things that we look at is, hey, you know, let's say you're increasingly, you know, a lot of companies are employing cloud-based DDoS security. What's interesting about that is when you are relying on a provider to, you know, and you're pushing all your traffic to them, they're essentially your primary ISP, right? So, and they're a multi-tenant infrastructure. And what if you're not under attack, but someone else is under attack? And as a result, their infrastructure, the, you know, the security provider's infrastructure is under stress and your website experience is suffering. So one of the things that we encourage folks to do is just be monitoring to see if there's sort of collateral damage issues. So there's a lot of subtleties in terms of how the internet's kind of vulnerabilities can affect you.
So Alex, I know we've got to have a bunch of people asking, 1,000 eyes, does that mean I have to go put 1,000 nodes out there? Or am I buying into this infrastructure you guys built? I've seen a little bit of what you did at Interop, but why don't you tell our viewers, what does it take to get started and to buy into those 1,000 eyes of visibility?
So the way that we set this up, particularly if you're trying to understand the delivery of an app or service and all the network aspects from the point of view of users out on the internet to, let's say, a service that you're hosting or an app that you're delivering to the internet, then basically it's dead simple because we've already set up, you know, thousands and thousands of these monitoring agents in about 175 cities around the world. So you can basically go to our SaaS app. You choose which agents you want to turn on. You choose which kind of tests you run. Let's say I want to run HTTP, tests and CNetwork PaaS and CBGP, and you know I want to do that from 40 cities, right? You can do that in a few minutes. You get it going, and basically the rest is just kind of done for you. You choose a frequency. You don't have to set up anything. You don't have to deploy any software anywhere. Basically, you're just pointing out your URLs. And that's all you need to know. And the rest of it, all the visuals, all the path visualization, all the correlation, all that functionality, then just kind of, you just get it. So it's really super simple to get going on that basis. Now, if you're running a major application, you know and that it's not just the front door that matters, but it's also all the back-end things. You know, most applications now depend on third parties, right? So let's say if you're processing payments, you don't do that internally. You're gonna have a payment processor provider, right? And et cetera, tax calculations and all that sort of thing. So what you might do in that case is say, all right, I'm going to put an enterprise agent, the same software as the cloud agents, but I'm going to deploy that in a Docker or a Linux package or a VM or what have you, lots and lots of different ways. Put that in my data center. And now I'm going to monitor those external services and providers and see how they're performing for me. You know, so there's a little bit of deployment there, but really, you know, from one agent, you can in a data center or in your cloud VPC, you can now see all those other services, and then you just consume all that visualization and data and dashboards and everything from our SaaS app.
Fantastic. Alex, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time. Maybe you could tell the folks at home where they can go to learn about 1,000 Eyes, where they could go to get started, how can they get started, so on and so forth.
So I'm going to mention two things. One is thousandeyes.com is where you can go to just check out our product. You can start a free trial. You can, you know, if you want to get some more assists, you can ask for help there. The other thing is blog.thousandeyes.com has a ton of great stories, including there's a great blog post, by the way, since you just mentioned the other sponsor by one of the network leaders at Atlassian about how they use Thousand Eyes to figure out performance between their data centers and their AWS instances. It's a great story. So there's a lot of fun stories on our blog as well.
Thanks again, Alex. And again, Thousand Eyes is a sponsor of TWiA and the TWiT Network. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast, according to 9 out of 10 DDoS packets. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-hosts in crime, starting with our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. It's always great having you here, sir. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
On Twitter, I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or drop me a line. I am Chibert at twit.tv. But I tell you what, better yet, drop it to Twiet at twit.tv and it hit all the hosts. And you know what? I like the title suggested in by Mobeta Wi-Fi. The internet is an unregulated chain of trust.
I'm gonna use that myself, Alex. I think that was a great line. Of course, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your fabulous work?
Well, you can always find my writing at darkreading.com. I was off this week, which means that next week I should have even more stuff than normal to share with everyone. And I will point to that work over at Dark Reading from my Twitter account, KG4GWA, and my Instagram account, Kurt_Franklin. So join me in either of those places to see what I'm doing and find out what I think about security and maybe just a little bit more.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. Now, go to our show page right now at twit.tv/twiet. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, plus all the show notes about the co-hosts, guest information, and the links to our stories. But more importantly, next to the videos up there, you'll get those helpful download or subscribe links. Support the show by getting audio versions, video versions, and HD video versions of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices. It's really the best way to get your kind of your enterprise and IT fix for the week. After you subscribe, share us with your friends, your family. We love doing the show. And if you subscribe, we can continue to do it. Now, also remember, we do this show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays. And if you're going to come and watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well. We talk to a lot of people in there. We get some really great questions. That's at irc.twit.tv. Also, don't forget, you can follow me on twitter.com/LouMM. There you'll get to see all of my postings about my daily job at Microsoft. Plus, you can check out dev.office.com. where we post all the latest and greatest ways to customize Office and your experience with Office to make it more productive. I also want to kind of thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. But I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit as well. And of course, Mr. Brian Chibert. He's our tireless producer. He does all the bookings and plannings in the show, and we definitely couldn't do the show without him. And before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Victor. Welcome back, Victor. You know our tradition. What was the major topic of today's show?
Something about looking at the Facebook outage and looking into networks, right?
Sure. Getting our Instagram fixed, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So close. I would say it was more about app layer and network monitoring, but very close, sir. Maybe next time.
Sorry. I was more of thinking what my origin story would be, because you guys were talking about how we love origin stories here.
And we definitely do.
I was thinking it would end with I learned that with great power comes great responsibility. So
that it does. Well, maybe we'll get your origin story next time. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.